At a million other choices, we discuss some dark and troubling topics. If dark and troubling is not your thing, mine might not be the right podcast for you. If you like your dark topics discussed without pesky ads and are looking for some additional content from me, you can sign up for the exclusive feed. The link should be in the show notes, and if not, you can find me on redcircle.com. I research each case myself, and I do my best to use a wide variety of sources, preferably directly from court documents when they're available, to ensure that the information is as accurate as possible. But I cannot verify the truth of all reporting that is publicly available. So this episode has been produced for information and entertainment purposes only and should be taken as such. And with all my legal and publicity stuff out of the way, let's listen to what words I will inadvertently mispronounce today.
And I know the answer to the question that everyone keeps asking. I know why you did this. You did this simply because you were not in a cage.
But was she dead on the day I arrived? Or...
She was dead when you killed her.
I agree with the family. I hope you die in prison as well.
It disgusts me that you are allowed to exist.
I have a story for you today that's from 1976, so it's a little bit old, but it's a very interesting case. Because it's old, I did have to go through newspaper archives for the information, and I was able to find some appeal documents, but there was this really large, very detailed write-up in the Hamilton Spectator. It was called Secrets by Susan Claremont. Originally, she wrote it in November of 2008, which was really helpful for me for today's story to get tons of details. So kudos to Susan Claremont for actually attending court dates, tracking down interviews. She was actually the biggest source on this story, at least since 1976 when it all went down. She has actually been following this story for years. This is the murder of the Rallo family. Sandra Pollington was born in Hamilton, Ontario, to her parents, Margaret and Doug. Now, Doug had been a firefighter and later became fire chief in Cambridge. And when Sandra was only 15 years old, she met a man that was 5 years older than her, who was quite taken with the pretty brunette. His name was John Rallo. And John had been born on November 30th, 1942, also in Hamilton, to his parents, Dorothea and Jack. Now, Jack had been a forensic photographer taking pictures of crime scenes before moving on to become a manager at the Liquor Control Board. John wasn't the most conventionally attractive man, but he was very charming. He always dressed very sharply. His style and his confidence made him kind of enticing to be around. John had dropped out of school just before finishing his 12th year, but he did finish by taking some classes by correspondence and then went on to take some management and communication courses at Mohawk College. The couple married after 4 years of dating on October 8th, 1966. So Sandra would have been 19, and then they moved into a small apartment on Concession Street. John started to kind of move up in his work. He got a position as an office manager at the engineering department for the city. And Sandra, she took up yoga and she got a job doing title searches at a law firm. And when Sandra got pregnant with their first child in 1969, they moved into a house on Dundurn Street. And then on October 30th of that year, their son Jason was born. Then on June 30th, 1971, a daughter joined the family named Stephanie. The couple later settled into a house on 16 Lantana Court, which was a house on a very quiet street. There's only about seven houses on there, and did all the normal 1970 things. They drove a Ford Maverick, they got a cat for the kids, and life just kind of went on. The kids started school. Jason was just about to start grade two, and Stephanie had graduated from kindergarten. They both started playing t-ball. It was just normal life in the 70s growing up for us. But it wasn't the most settled of marriages. John had some affairs, and actually quite a few affairs. Sometimes he denied it. Sometimes he came clean about it. He also had a thing for pornography, and he kept a drawer full of some rather violent and kind of gross stuff. Now, Sandra didn't always find out about the affairs, but she did know that her husband was a little bit of a pig around the ladies. There was a coworker of John's named Julia. That they both say it was a platonic relationship, but I kind of doubt it. And then in the spring of 1975, he started having lunches with another coworker at the same engineering firm, Marjorie Smith. Now, Marjorie was also married at the time, but that didn't really matter to either one of them. And they started having this affair, including having sex sometimes in Sandra's house when she wasn't there. Marjorie says that after a few months of that, she ended things. Now, she says she ended it in August of 1975. They had started the affair in May of that year, but some letters that were found later in John's desk drawer would suggest that it actually went on pretty much till at least the end of 1975. But back at that summer, so that was the summer of 1975, their neighbor, Kay Scordino, she had come by one night to borrow some, scotch or something. And Kay started telling the whole neighborhood after that, that when he handed her the bottle, that he'd made a pass at her by touching her breast. Well, Sandra just about died of embarrassment over that. And it was just a whole big thing, almost ruined the friendship with everyone. But by the following summer, all had kind of been forgotten about and everybody was friends again. And so by the time August of 1976 came along, the neighbors were back to taking the odd vacation together, just kind of hanging out together. And so on Friday, August 14th, the two couples traveled to Sandra's parents' place for the weekend to enjoy like the pool and just kind of hang out and do a little skinny dipping. But Sandra caught John and Kay kind of getting a little bit closer than she thought they should have in the pool. So she was most displeased, you can say. And when they returned to their house on the Sundays, Sandra's like, no way, you're sleeping downstairs in the basement. But they did have motivation to work things out and to definitely stay friends with their neighbors, the Scordinos, because John was actually about to have this business venture with his father-in-law, so Sandra's father, and Kay Scordino's husband, Phil. So he needed to work things out and smooth them over with Sandra for sure. Like he couldn't have her going to her dad and then picking fights with the neighbors. Not at this point. So the family returned from Sandra's parents' place on the Sunday evening, and then Sandra went out to talk to a music teacher about setting up some piano lessons for them. And while she was out, one of her neighbors, Barb Swin, comes by for coffee with her, but Sandra's not home. So Jason and Stephanie, like the kids when they were getting ready for bed, so they got their PJs on, they went over to Barb's house to tell her that Sandra, like their mom's home now. So she goes back with the kids to the house and stays. She has coffee with her for about 2 hours. Meanwhile, John got the kids into their beds and then he went down to the basement to sleep. And when he got up the following morning, so this is Monday, August 16th, around 8:30 in the morning, Sandra and Jason, so Jason would have been 6 at the time, Stephanie was 5, and they were all gone. And there was this typewritten note from Sandra on his dresser telling him that she had left, like she and the kids had left, and she had left him for this rich lawyer. But it was interesting that she took the kids with her and her purse, but no clothes, no toys, not even a pair of shoes. So John said he was completely distraught and was just beside himself. So he called in sick to work and did what many of us would do when we're missing our loved ones. He took apart their marital bed and pulled up the carpet in the bedroom, like all the way, including some of the under padding, but he only took out the under padding part from what was actually under the bed where the bed had been. Now, why he did that is because he says one of the kids had vomited at some point and that the cat then had peed on the carpet and Sandra was complaining all the time that it was smelly. Then he did the laundry because that's what men that find themselves newly single, that's the first thing on their list to do. And then he went down to Canadian Tire, which is a hardware store here, and returned a light switch before going for a drive down along the beach, but through like Toronto, Brantford, and Caledonia, which is quite a long drive, before coming home. It was after midnight by that point, and then he decided to get on his bike, and while he was riding his bike, he fell off, cut his hands. And if all of that sounds really suspicious to you, don't worry, because it is. So the next day, so now it's the Wednesday. Oh, and on the Tuesday, anyone that called for Sandra, including the daycare, she told him she wasn't home. But on the Wednesday, he gets up early on 5 a.m., cleans the house, you know, just to sort of keep busy. Now he tells Barb on that day that she's gone, that she has left with the kids for this rich lawyer, and he's very sad about it. And then he shows up at his father-in-law, Doug's office, with the note that she had typewritten, and he's crying and sobbing and all kinds of pathetic over his wife and kids leaving him for this other man. Well, John goes with Sandra's mom, Marg, over to his parents' house to tell them what had happened. And his mom's like, you know, you should probably get those cuts on your hand taken care of. They don't look so good. And he says, no, it's fine. There's no sense bothering about that. So then he starts telling everyone, like, he should have seen this coming, because starting last summer, so a year before, he had started getting phone calls from this anonymous man who he said didn't identify himself, but did seem to know quite a bit of personal details about them. Now, he had confronted Sandra about it, thinking that it was some guy that she was having an affair with, but she denied knowing who this guy was. Well, on that same day, so the Wednesday, over in St. Catharines, a mom and her two sons, Sean, who was 13, and Paul, 11, were going to go fishing at Jordan Harbor. And the boys wandered off a little bit to do some exploring and discovered a duffel bag in the water. It was sort of near the shore. And when they grabbed it and opened it, they saw a body of a small child and, of course, screamed for their mother, who called the police. And the girl in the bag was naked. She had bruises on her forehead, but was unidentified at that point. Now, by Thursday morning, John went back to work. But what he doesn't know is that Doug Pollington, so Sandra's dad, has already reported Sandra and the kids as missing. So at 10 a.m., when a sergeant from the Hamilton police shows up to take this missing persons report from him, he's like, oh yeah, I was just going to call you. Like, sure he was. Well, this sergeant, after talking to John, hears from another officer that the body of a child has been found. Is around Stephanie's age at the 12 Mile Creek. So he gets a photo of Stephanie and he goes to the morgue. He's pretty sure the girl matches the picture. So Doug, basically Stephanie's grandfather, has the unenviable job of identifying little Stephanie for them. And John is called to meet the detectives at the station that afternoon to just kind of go over some things. He says, sure, but first he stops at the bank. And like, this is on the way to the police station to take Sandra's name off of their joint account, and tells the cops all about this mystery guy that was been calling in the note and how his wife left and took his kids. And he doesn't think he's ever going to be able to forgive her, even if they find her. So they tell him that, well, we've actually found Stephanie's body. And he puts his head on the officer's shoulder for comfort, but he doesn't really cry about it. And they notice that. So they ask if they can search his house. And surprisingly, probably arrogantly, he says, sure, no problemo. And when he's asked, like, why is your house a mess? Like, the carpet's ripped up, you've got the mattresses out in the hallway. Well, he tells them all this BS about taking the bed apart and ripping up the carpets for basically something to do, and because he's mad about his wife leaving, and that he took the carpet or part of the carpet to this Glanford dump. And maybe his arrogance had something to do with him thinking that he's just smarter than everybody, because the carpet, which of course was bloodstained, with type B blood, which matched Sandra's, was actually found at the Ottawa Street dump. So I guess he figured that he was throwing them off track, and if they went to the wrong dump, they wouldn't be able to find anything. But he didn't really do much cleaning of any blood droplets and smears, which were found in the bathroom of the house, the basement, and on some drapes in the bedroom. So John was charged with the murder of Stephanie, and he was detained while they searched for the bodies of Sandra and Jason. And on August 26, officers can see from this search helicopter an object in the water with some feet sticking out at the Welland Canal. It was a green sleeping bag stuffed with a second blue sleeping bag, and inside the blue sleeping bag was two plastic garbage bags, and inside of those was the body of Sandra Rallo. And the blue sleeping bag had a name tag reading Jason Rallo. So there were two more charges of murder added to John's charges. And the autopsies revealed that Stephanie had died of asphyxia due to suffocation from what they think was firm pressure applied to the face. And then Sandra had also died ultimately of asphyxia, likely by manual strangulation, but had evidence of having been beaten before she was strangled. She had a hole above her right ear, bruising on her thighs, forearms, and her face, and her nose was broken. So John was actually remarkably out on bail while he waited for his trial to start. And he actually asked if he could return to his job with the city, but they said no. And so his trial finally started in November of 1977.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now, the prosecutor's theory was that John had been actually planning to get rid of at least his wife for some time, planting this story about this mysterious rich lawyer. They had a fight that night. He punches her in the face, which causes blood spatter on the drapes. And there was also a bench as well as the mattress. And he strangles Sandra, probably with, they think, the cord from the blinds. The kids come in to see what all the fuss is about, and then he suffocates both of them. Now, personally, I think that the kids were actually in their beds at the time and that he used like a pillow to suffocate them with. He then carries all three bodies down to the basement where he takes off their clothes, which he puts in the laundry, leaving some blood drippings on the concrete floor, which he doesn't bother to clean up. Takes two garbage bags and puts one over Sandra's head and then the other one up over her feet. And her legs, and then shoves her into a sleeping bag and then ties two anchors to the bag and then binds it all up with some rope. Now, Stephanie's a little bit smaller, so she only required one garbage bag and then shoved her body into this duffel bag. Jason, they think, was put into a garbage bag and probably a sleeping bag. He also then ripped up the carpet and the mattress, types up this note that he did and takes the bodies out to the garage, and then puts them into the trunk of the car and then dumps them along the St. Catharines around there. So John testified on his own behalf that, his original story about sleeping in the basement, finding them all gone, all his chores that he's doing around the house and this bike ride that he went on when he was hurt is all true, nothing but true. Now, the evidence against him, of course, was rather compelling. Sterling McGilvery, who lived down the street, was kitty-cornered to their house at 7 Laytona Court. He testified that he had gotten up at 5:30 in the morning on August 17th and opened his living room drapes and saw that the light was on in their master bedroom, which he thought was a little bit odd because they're not usually early risers. More odd was seeing John kneeling on the floor in the bedroom doing something like maybe scrubbing or pulling at something. A number of people testified that they had called the house on the 17th and that John told them that Sandra was out and that she would be back later. And if they did call back, he then said, oh no, she came home, but then she left again.
A security guard at the Upper Ottawa Street dump, Vince Colantino, said police showed him a man's photograph on Monday, August 23rd, 1976. He said he saw the man come to the dump around 9:20 to 9:30 a.m. the previous Wednesday, August 18th, in a small car. In the back seat were three bulky green garbage bags and two boxes. Colantino identified that man as the accused.
John had told Barb Swin, his father-in-law, his lawyer, and a private investigator named Ron Arnold that his lawyer had sort of encouraged him to hire to find his wife and kids, that he had fallen off of his bike and that's how he got his hand injured. But a doctor testified that that was really unlikely, that the injuries were considered like multiple wounds that would not be consistent with a single fall and were more likely to have been caused by an impact with someone's teeth, like when you punch someone in the face. And then a 3-foot by 5-foot piece of beige carpeting was found with some ominous dark stains on it. It was tested by a biologist that it had come from their master bedroom and that the carpeting in that room had been completely removed, like right into the closet. The drapes in the room had several blood spatters on them, about 3 feet up, and each of the stains were human blood type B, which not only matched Sandra's type, but had actually whittled it down to have come, it could only have come from about 9% of the population. There was also blood found on the box spring of the bed that was consistent with blood being spattered from blunt force. The remaining bits of carpet were found in the basement and actually laid down on the basement floor. There were blood smears on this piece of carpet, and they appeared to have been washed or attempted to be washed of some stains. The mattress had some cuts in it too, like it was sort of in the corner. There were stains there too that were consistent with an attempt to be washed or scrubbed out. Now, John tried to explain away all this blood in the master bedroom by saying it was from a nosebleed that Sandra had. The blood in the garage, he said, was from a cut that she had gotten on her foot, and that the mattress had these sections cut out because Stephanie had thrown up on it at one point. Well, the jury didn't buy any of that and convicted him, and he was given 3 life sentences, but of course with parole eligibility after 25 years. Which, of course, he appealed on a bunch of stupid grounds. And the appeal court said the evidence against the appellate was so compelling as not to admit of any reasonable interference other than that of the appellant's guilt. We also observe that apart from the complaints referred to, the learned trial judge's charge after 16 days of trial was a model of clarity in which the issues were clearly delineated and the evidence related to them, since we are satisfied that a reasonable jury, probably charged, would on the evidence legally admissible have inevitably convicted, this appeal must be dismissed. Now, this being an old case, we get to sort of review the passage of time and see how his incarceration went. 2 years in, he met a woman named Winnie Barnes while he was doing some community work at this thrift store that she was working at, and she started to visit him in prison. In fact, they started having conjugal visits over the years. Now, the prison never mentioned any of this to the parole board, who by 1986 had started giving him some escorted leaves to attend family gatherings at his parents' house. Now, Sandra's parents, Marg and Doug, were never advised of any of these absences. In 1990, he was transferred to Beaver Creek, which is a minimum security prison with a golf course and some nice views. In 1999, he applied for early parole under this faint hope clause that we used to have. That was denied, mostly because he still hadn't taken any ownership over the murders. He still refused to say where he had dumped Jason's body. Like, he just basically would not admit that what he had done. So at the time of this recording, Jason's body has actually never been found. John has never admitted his guilt over any of it. Sandra's sister Janice has visited John in prison a number of times, begging him to tell her where his body is, but he has refused to say.
The fact that he never owned up to the responsibility of the murder, the fact that he's, you know, the one thing that the families always asked for, that they just said, you know, just please tell us where our nephew is so we can give him a proper burial. And he never gave that information, nor did he show much remorse.
Now, beginning in 2001, he did start becoming eligible for parole, like day parole. He was about 60 years old then. But at each hearing, when the parole board would bring up the evidence against him and ask him to take responsibility for his crimes, he would actually get angry, and described by Susan Claremont, who of course was all over this case and actually attended these hearings, as explosive. So he would get denied. Now, he wanted unescorted leaves or unescorted absences. He talked that his plans at the time were to move back to Hamilton, which is where Sandra's family was still living. And in 2002, he did a work placement program in Sudbury, and he started to tell the parole board that instead, you know, he would maybe thinking about moving there. He would get a YMCA membership, learn to speak some French, saying to the board, quote, "I would see the sights of the city. I'd keep myself busy. I hope you can appreciate, sir. I have a lot of catching up to do," end quote. Mar, Cassandra's mom, said, to this day, the constant ever-growing fear exists in our minds that the body of that beautiful young boy will never be found. When I cannot sleep, I come downstairs and look out my window and wonder where Jason is. John had a car and a suitcase. If he wasn't happy, all he had to do was leave. End quote. Then, in 2008, he cried at the hearing, and he was able to get day parole so that he could live 4 nights of the week with his girlfriend, with Winnie, and 3 nights at this halfway house, but he still wasn't eligible for full parole because he still would not take ownership over what he had done. So he was sent to live in this halfway house, so during the weekdays he would stay with... I think it was during the weekdays he would stay at the halfway house, and on the weekends he would spend with his girlfriend. He was able to go to Hamilton still and attend some family gatherings. He could do that unescorted, unsupervised. His parents, Jack and Dorothea, they were still alive at that time, and they welcomed him home whenever he wanted to go home. In 2011, he told the parole board, after 35 years, I'm just tired of banging my head against the wall. I'm just tired. Nobody listens. And his girlfriend, Winnie, told the parole board that only John and God know the truth of what happened to Sandra and their children. Then in 2013, he was denied full parole again. He actually shouted at the board, if you're never going to give me full parole, just tell me to stop this charade. So the board responded by saying, the board has continued to have concerns with your stance of denial with the index offense, as this suggests your risk factors are unknown and unaddressed. And then, of course, the fact that he continues to deny his involvement with his wife and his children's deaths continues to cause serious psychological harm to the victim's family. Now, in 2015, his mom, Dorothea, died. Then in the spring of 2020, something a few of you might remember that happened, COVID started to break out. And because at this point, John was now 76 years old, he had some heart issues, he was considered vulnerable. So the Parole Board of Canada gave him what is called extended leave for medical purposes. So he was allowed to live at that time full-time with Winnie because the halfway house would have been too close quarters with others. So Winnie had actually moved into a new apartment at that time, and John had been staying with her for 4 days a week, but now he could do that full-time, at least for the next 90 days, which started in May, but then that was extended another 6 months when the parole board did this review, looking over some paperwork and determined that he had built a relationship with other tenants in the building and have been participating in various activities in the complex that are geared towards seniors. Now, some of this paperwork that they looked at was an updated psychiatric assessment that showed that he was a low risk to reoffend. Now, I should mention here that Winnie has adult children of her own, and she's now a grandmother, and John refers to her kids as his own grandchildren, something he never let his children live long enough to have his own grandchildren. And because the in-person hearings weren't really a thing in February of 2021, there was no in-person hearing. So Sandra's sister Janice, who had attended every hearing up until then, usually doing it with her parents until they died in 2011, she wasn't able to attend, but she did write in asking that his COVID leave not be extended. Quote, he is a triple murderer who savagely killed my family. What is more detestable is that now he wants special consideration. He never showed any consideration or compassion when he killed my family, end quote. They also never bothered at this one to bring up his offenses or any of the evidence against him, so he was just kind of relaxed. He didn't have any outbursts of any rage. So he was granted full parole in 2021, and he has been living in Sudbury with Winnie ever since. He's now in his 80s. Now, Marg and Doug, her parents, had fought really hard over the years to try and make sure that John never saw freedom. They also worked as victim advocates over the year for other victims. The Parole Board of Canada said that there was probably no other family in Canada who had such a long relationship with the justice system. Now, Marg, who was always a very friendly and caring woman, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and she spent her last years in a long-term care home. And Doug stayed in their home until he had a heart attack a few years later. So then he went and he had to live in a separate long-term care home. Now, even the fact that he needed oxygen at that time and a walker, he was still making his way to Tim Hortons every day to get donuts for the nurses. And in July 2018, Marg passed away peacefully. The very next day, Doug also suffered a second heart attack and died. So Janice now at this point remains the only living relative of Sandra, Jason, and Stephanie. And she at least feels at peace that she doesn't have to go to any more parole hearings. Now Jason's remains, as I said, have never been found. John Rallo continues to deny having anything to do with any of their deaths. And at the time of this recording, he is still alive and living out, just living his life in Sudbury. And that was the terrible murder of the Rallo family. It was kind of one of the original Chris Watts kind of cases. He's a family annihilator. I'll never understand why having an affair means you kill your wife and family. I just don't understand it. But anyways, that was the case. I will see you again next week with another case that's terrible and horrible and awful. And as always, you know what to do. Do your rate review thing. Sign up for the exclusive. I will see you back here next week. Thank you so much for listening.
Saving money now during Menards Bag Sale. All prices after 15% bag sale discount. Pick up a 6-pack of LED light bulbs for just $2.97. Get a wood or fiberglass claw hammer for only $2.29 each. 52-ounce bottles of Ajax dish soap, just $2.97. And 12 packs of Shasta soda in assorted flavors are only $4.19. Don't miss out on Menards Bag Sale happening now. Good through January 12th. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.